A Message from the Deep Sea by R. Austin Freeman. From John Thorndike's Cases, a Collection of Short Stories by R. Austin Freeman. A Message from the Deep Sea. The Whitechapel Road, though redeemed by scattered relics of a more picturesque past, from the utter desolation of its neighbor, the Commercial Road, is hardly a gay thoroughfare, especially at its eastern end, where its sordid modernity seems to reflect the colorless lives of its inhabitants, does its gray and dreary length depress the spirits of the wayfarer. But the longest and dullest road can be made delightful by sprightly discourse seasoned with wit and wisdom. And so it was that, as I walked westward by the side of my friend John Thorndike, the long, monotonous road seemed all too short. We had been to the London hospital to see a remarkable case of acromegaly, and as we returned, we discussed this curious affliction and the allied condition of gigantism in all their bearings, from the origin of the Gibson chin to the physique of Og, King of Bashan. "It would have been interesting," Thorndike remarked as we passed up Aldgate High Street, "to have put one's finger into His Majesty's pituitary fossa. After his decease, of course. By the way, here is Harrow Alley. You remember Defoe's description of the dead cart waiting out here, and the ghastly procession coming down the alley." He took my arm and led me up the narrow thoroughfare as far as the sharp turn by the Star and Still public house, where we turned and looked back. "I never passed this place," he said musingly, "but I seemed to hear the clang of the bell and the dismal cry of the carter." He broke off abruptly. Two figures had suddenly appeared framed in the archway, and now advanced at headlong speed. One, who led, was a stout, middle-aged Jewess, very breathless and disheveled. The other was a well-dressed young man, hardly less agitated than his companion. As they approached, the young man suddenly recognized my colleague, and accosted him in agitated tones. "I've just been sent for to a case of murder or suicide. Would you mind looking at it for me, sir? It's my first case, and I feel rather nervous." Here the woman darted back and plucked the young doctor by the arm. "Hurry! Hurry!" she exclaimed. "Don't stop to talk." Her face was as white as lard and shiny with sweat. Her lips twitched, her hands shook, and she stared with the eyes of a frightened child. "Of course I will come, Hart," said Thorndike, and turning back, we followed the woman as she elbowed her way frantically among the foot passengers. "Have you started in practice here?" Thorndike asked as we hurried along. "No, sir," replied Dr. Hart. "I am an assistant. My principal is the police surgeon, but he is out just now. It's very good of you to come with me, sir."
"Tut, tut," rejoined Thorndike.
"I am just coming to see that you do credit to my teaching. That looks like the house." We had followed our guide into a side street, halfway down which we could see a knot of people clustered round a doorway. They watched us as we approached, and drew aside to let us enter. The woman whom we were following rushed into the passage with the same headlong haste with which she had traversed the streets, and so up the stairs. But as she neared the top of the flight, she slowed down suddenly, and began to creep up on tiptoe with noiseless and hesitating steps. On the landing, she turned to face us, and pointing a shaking forefinger at the door of the back room, whispered almost inaudibly, "She's in there!" and then sank, half-fainting, on the bottom stair of the next flight. I laid my hand on the knob of the door, and looked back at Thorndike. He was coming slowly up the stairs, closely scrutinizing floor, walls, and handrail as he came. When he reached the landing, I turned the handle, and we entered the door together, closing the door after us. The blind was still down, and in the dim, uncertain light, nothing out of the common was, at first, to be seen. The shabby little room looked trim and orderly enough, save for a heap of cast-off feminine clothing piled upon a chair. The bed appeared undisturbed, except by the half-seen shape of its occupant, and the quiet face, dimly visible in its shadowy corner, might have been that of a sleeper, but for its utter stillness, and for a dark stain on the pillow by its side. Dr. Hart stole on tiptoe to the bedside,
while Thorndyke drew up the blind, and as the garish daylight poured into the room, the young surgeon fell back with a gasp of horror. "Good God!" he exclaimed. "Poor creature! But this is a frightful thing, sir!" The light streamed down upon the white face of a handsome girl of 25, a face peaceful, placid, and beautiful, with the austere and almost unearthly beauty of the youthful dead. The lips were slightly parted, the eyes half-closed and drowsy, shaded with sweeping lashes, and a wealth of dark hair and massive plaits served as a foil to the translucent skin. Our friend had drawn back the bedclothes a few inches, and now there was revealed, beneath the comely face, so serene and inscrutable, and yet so dreadful in its fixity and waxen pallor, a horrible yawning wound that almost divided the shapely neck. Thorndyke looked down with stern pity at the plump white face. "It was savagely done," said he, "and yet mercifully, by reason of its very savagery. She must have died without waking." "The brute!" exclaimed Hart, clenching his fists and turning crimson with wrath. "The infernal cowardly beast! He shall hang! By God, he shall hang!" In his fury, the young fellow shook his fists in the air, even as the moisture welled up into his eyes. Thorndyke touched him on the shoulder. "That is what we are here for, Hart," said he. "Get out your notebook." And with this, he bent down over the dead girl. At the friendly reproof, the young surgeon pulled himself together, and with open notebook, commenced his investigation, while I, at Thorndyke's request, occupied myself in making a plan of the room, with a description of its contents and their arrangements. But this occupation did not prevent me from keeping an eye on Thorndyke's movements, and presently I suspended my labors to watch him as, with a pocket knife, he scraped together some objects that he had found on the pillow. "What do you make of this?" he asked, as I stepped over to his side. He pointed with the blade to a tiny heap of what looked like silver sand, and as I looked more closely, I saw that similar particles were sprinkled on other parts of the pillow. "Silver sand!" I exclaimed. "I don't understand at all how it can have got there. Do you?" Thorndyke shook his head. "We will consider the explanation later," was his reply. He had produced from his pocket a small metal box which he always carried, and which contained such requisites as coverslips, capillary tubes, moulding wax, and other diagnostic materials. He now took from it a seed envelope, into which he neatly shoveled the little pinch of sand with his knife. He had closed the envelope, and was writing a penciled description on the outside, when we were startled by a cry from Hart. "Good God, sir! Look at this! It was done by a woman!" He had drawn back the bedclothes, and was staring aghast at the dead girl's left hand. It held a thin tress of long red hair. Thorndyke hastily pocketed his specimen, and stepping round the little bedside table, bent over the hand with knitted brows. It was closed, though not tightly clenched, and when an attempt was made gently to separate the fingers, they were found to be as rigid as the fingers of a wooden hand. Thorndyke stooped yet more closely, and taking out his lens, scrutinized the wisp of hair throughout its entire length. "There is more here than meets the eye at the first glance," he remarked. "What say you, Hart?" He held out his lens to his quondam pupil, who was about to take it from him, when the door opened and three men entered. One was a police inspector, the second appeared to be a plainclothes officer, while the third was evidently the divisional surgeon. "Friends of yours, Hart?" inquired the latter, regarding us with some disfavor. Thorndyke gave a brief explanation of our presence, to which the newcomer rejoined, "Well, sir, your locus standi here is a matter for the inspector. My assistant was not authorized to call in outsiders. You needn't wait, Hart." With that, he proceeded to his inspection, while Thorndyke withdrew the pocket thermometer that he had slipped under the body and took the reading.
The inspector, however, was not disposed to exercise the prerogative at which the surgeon had hinted, for an expert has his uses. "How long should you say she's been dead, sir?" he asked affably. "About 10 hours," replied Thorndyke. The inspector and the detective simultaneously looked at their watches.
"That fixes it at 2 o'clock this morning," said the former. "What's that, sir?"
The surgeon was pointing to the wisp of hair in the dead girl's hand.
"My word!" exclaimed the inspector. "A woman, eh? She must be a tough customer. This looks like a soft job for you, sergeant."
"Yes," said the detective. "That accounts for that box with the hassock on it at the head of the bed. She had to stand on them to reach over, but she couldn't have been very tall."
"She must have been mighty strong, though," said the inspector.
"Why, she has nearly cut the poor wench's head off."
He moved round to the head of the bed, and, stooping over, peered down at the gaping wound. Suddenly, he began to draw his hand over the pillow, and then rub his fingers together.
"Why," he exclaimed, "there's sand on the pillow. Silver sand. Now, how can that have come here?"
The surgeon and the detective both came round to verify this discovery, and an earnest consultation took place as to its meaning.
"Did you notice it, sir?"
the inspector asked Thorndyke.
"Yes," replied the latter. "It's an unaccountable thing, isn't it?"
"I don't know that it is either," said the detective.
He ran over to the washstand and then uttered a grunt of satisfaction.
"It's quite a simple matter after all, you see,"
he said, glancing complacently at my colleague.
"There's a ball of sand soap on the washstand, and the basin is full of blood-stained water. You see, she must have washed the blood off her hands, and off the knife, too. A pretty cool customer she must be. And then she used the sand soap. Then, while she was drying her hands, she must have stood over the head of the bed and let the sand fall onto the pillow. I think that's clear enough."
"Admirably clear," said Thorndyke. "And what do you suppose was the sequence of events?" The gratified detective glanced round the room.
"I take it," said he, "that the deceased read herself to sleep. There is a book on the table by the bed, and a candlestick with nothing in it but a bit of burned wick at the bottom of the socket. I imagine that the woman came in quietly, lit the gas, put the box and the hassock at the bed head, stood on them, and cut her victim's throat. Deceased must have waked up and clutched the murderess's hair, though there doesn't seem to have been much of a struggle, but no doubt she died almost at once. Then the murderess washed her hands, cleaned the knife, tidied up the bed a bit, and went away. That's about how things happened, I think. But how she got in without anyone hearing, and how she got out, and where she went to, are the things that we've got to find out."
"Perhaps," said the surgeon, drawing the bedclothes over the corpse, "we had better have the landlady in and make a few inquiries."
He glanced significantly at Thorndyke, and the inspector coughed behind his hand. My colleague, however, chose to be obtuse to these hints. Opening the door, he turned the key backwards and forwards several times, drew it out, examined it narrowly, and replaced it. "The landlady is outside on the landing," he remarked, holding the door open. Thereupon, the inspector went out, and we all followed to hear the result of his inquiries.
"Now, Mrs. Goldstein," said the officer, opening his notebook, "I want you to tell us all that you know about this affair and about the girl herself. What was her name?"
The landlady, who had been joined by a white-faced, tremulous man, wiped her eyes and replied in a shaky voice,
Her name, poor child, was Minna Adler. She was a German. She came from Bremen about 2 years ago. She had no friends in England. No relatives, I mean. She was a waitress at a restaurant in Fenchurch Street, and a good, quiet, hard-working girl."
"When did you discover what had happened?"
"About 11 o'clock. I thought she had gone to work as usual, but my husband noticed from the backyard that her blind was still down. So I went up and knocked, and when I got no answer, I opened the door and went in, and then I saw..."
Here the poor soul, overcome by the dreadful recollection, burst into hysterical sobs.
"Your door was unlocked, then. Did she usually lock it?"
I think so," sobbed Mrs. Goldstein. "The key was always inside.
And the street door, was that secure when you came down this morning?
It was shut. We don't bolt it because some of the lodgers come home rather late.
And now tell us, had she any enemies? Was there anyone who had a grudge against her?
No, no, poor child. Why should anyone have a grudge against her? No, she had no quarrel, no real quarrel with anyone, not even with Miriam.
Miriam? Inquired the inspector.
Who was she?
That was nothing, interposed the man hastily. That was not a quarrel.
Just a little unpleasantness, I suppose, Mr. Goldstein, suggested the inspector.
Just a little foolishness about a young man, said Mr. Goldstein.
That was all. Miriam was a little jealous, but it was nothing.
No, no, of course. We all know that young women are apt to.
A soft footstep had been for some time audible, slowly descending the stair above, and at this moment a turn of the staircase brought the newcomer into view. And at that vision the inspector stopped short as if petrified, and a tense, startled silence fell upon us all. Down the remaining stairs there advanced towards us a young woman, powerful though short, wild-eyed, disheveled, horror-stricken, and of a ghastly pallor, and her hair was a fiery red. Stock still and speechless, we all stood as this apparition came slowly towards us. But suddenly the detective slipped back into the room, closing the door after him, to reappear a few moments later, holding a small paper packet, which, after a quick glance at the inspector, he placed in his breast pocket.
"This is my daughter Miriam that we spoke about, gentlemen," said Mr. Goldstein. "Miriam, those are the doctors and the police."
The girl looked at us from one to the other.
"You have seen her, then," she said in a strange, muffled voice, and added, "She isn't dead, is she? Not really dead?"
The question was asked in a tone at once coaxing and despairing, such as a distracted mother might use over the corpse of her child. It filled me with vague discomfort, and unconsciously I looked round towards Thorndyke. To my surprise, he had vanished. Noiselessly backing towards the head of the stairs, where I could command a view of the hall or passage, I looked down and saw him in the act of reaching up to a shelf behind the street door. He caught my eye and beckoned, whereupon I crept away unnoticed by the party on the landing. When I reached the hall, he was wrapping up three small objects, each in a separate cigarette paper, and I noticed that he handled them with more than ordinary tenderness.
"We didn't want to see that poor devil of a girl arrested," said he, as he deposited the three little packets gingerly in his pocket box. "Let us be off."
He opened the door noiselessly and stood for a moment, turning the latch backwards and forwards, and closely examining its bolt. I glanced up at the shelf behind the door. On it were two flat china candlesticks, in one of which I had happened to notice, as we came in, a short end of a candle lying in the tray, and I now looked to see if that was what Thorndyke had annexed. But it was still there. I followed my colleague out onto the street, and for some time we walked on without speaking.
"You guessed what the sergeant had in that paper, of course," said Thorndyke at length.
"Yes, it was the hair from the dead woman's hand, and I thought that he had much better have left it there."
"Undoubtedly. But that is the way in which well-meaning policemen destroy valuable evidence. Not that it matters much in this particular instance, but it might have been a fatal mistake."
"Do you intend to take any active part in this case?" I asked.
"That depends on circumstances. I have collected some evidence, but what it is worth I don't yet know. Neither do I know whether the police have observed the same set of facts. But I need not say that I shall do anything that seems necessary to assist the authorities. That is a matter of common citizenship."
The inroads made upon our time by the morning's adventures made it necessary that we should go each about his respective business without delay. So, after a perfunctory lunch at a tea-shop, we separated, and I did not see my colleague again until the day's work was finished, and I turned into our chambers just before dinner-time. Here I found Thorndyke seated at the table, and evidently full of business. A microscope stood close by, with a condenser throwing a spot of light onto a pinch of powder that had been sprinkled onto the slide. His collecting box lay open before him, and he was engaged, rather mysteriously, in squeezing a thick white cement from a tube onto three little pieces of moulding wax. "Useful stuff, this Fortifix," he remarked. "It makes excellent casts, and saves the trouble and mess of mixing plaster, which is a consideration for small work like this. By the way, if you want to know what was on that poor girl's pillow, just take a peep through the microscope. It is rather a pretty specimen." I stepped across and applied my eye to the instrument. The specimen was indeed pretty in more than a technical sense. Mingled with crystalline grains of quartz, glassy spicules, and water-worn fragments of coral, were a number of lovely little shells, some of the texture of fine porcelain, others like blown Venetian glass. "These are foraminifera," I exclaimed. "Yes. Then it is not silver sand, after all?" "Certainly not." "But what is it, then?" Thorndyke smiled. "It is a message to us from the deep sea, Jervis, from the floor of the eastern Mediterranean."
"And can you read the message?"
"I think I can," he replied. "But I shall know soon, I hope." End of part 1.